from the National Humanities Center. This is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Science and Ethics, Ancient to Modern, this week on Soundings. First, a conversation with Philip Mitzis of Cornell University and Jennifer Whiting of the University of Pittsburgh. Following that, a discussion with the president of the University of Notre Dame, the Reverend Edward Malloy, about science and ethics in modern society. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Philip Mitzis worked on a forthcoming study entitled Science and Morality in Hellenistic Thought. Tell me about the discipline of ethics. How did Socrates think about that himself? Before our conversation, Phil, you said that he sort of invented this as a discipline. Am I on the right track?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. I mean, of course, before Socrates, there was lots of ethical speculation, and there were philosophers before Socrates who thought about ethical problems and the kinds of things that we worry about when we're doing ethics. But I think what Socrates was the first to do is to really think about it as a self-conscious discipline, that he developed a method of his own for testing whether an ethical opinion was true or false, or whether it was consistent. One of the things he was doing, I mean, were the kinds of problems that he was facing. I mean, there were problems of the deterioration of religious belief, problems with political institutions, problems with the status of women and slaves, all the kinds of, you know, problematic ethical questions that we face today.
You're talking about categories and descriptions and situations where ethical claims rise and people talk about ethics. And was he saying that is what is out there, or was he saying this is the way we should live? Phil?
Well, I think those are very problematic categories for Greek thought. I mean, it's not clear that people before Socrates were necessarily making that distinction, and that might be a problem, because sometimes, say, a natural philosopher before Socrates might describe regularities in the natural world, which we would view as completely descriptive, but they would also take them as kinds of normative claims.
I see. Jennifer Whiting.
I think it's important to realize that Socrates' refusal to appeal to nature to support claims about how we ought to live and about what's good for human beings appeared to some of his successors, anyhow, to undermine his attempt to combat the relativistic views. One might think that it's less controversial, for example, that certain things are good for, in the sense of being healthy for, an animal, and that this is something we can establish by some sort of empirical observation. And if you treat, as I think Aristotle later did, ethics in something like the same way in which you treat medicine, as an empirical investigation about how things are actually structured and about what's good and bad for them in the sense of healthy and unhealthy, beneficial and harmful for them, then I think because the claims about what's healthy and unhealthy seem less controversial, because the claims about what our nature actually is seem less controversial to people, Aristotle thought that that would be one way to combat relativism, to try to tie claims about how we ought to live, what's good for us in a broader sense than just what's healthy and unhealthy for us, to try to tie claims about that to claims about our nature.
Mm-hmm.
No, I think it's true that in philosophers following Socrates, you get an attempt to defend ethical claims using a much wider range of information, both about the natural world, about causality, about the nature of metaphysics. I think that's all very true. I would still want to claim, though, that even within Socrates, there's an appeal to certain natural things about human beings. That is, something like we all want to be happy, that things like virtue or maybe pleasure will contribute to happiness. That seems to me a claim about man's natural functions.
Just parenthetically, Jennifer Whiting, Phil Mitzis, tell me, why do we use, why do we resort to Socrates and Plato when we talk about ethics? Is this because they were the best at what they did, or the first? In what ways did they send us signals and models that
I think there's some of both. I mean, Socrates appears in these wonderful dialogues by Plato that are just by themselves works of art, and so that's why he's a very appealing figure. I think the personality of Socrates is also often very appealing to people. Mm-hmm. So I think there's something about being first, but also I think there's a renewed interest in Greek ethics in general because of problems that modern ethical philosophers have been facing. I mean, if you look at the way, well, for the past couple hundred years, the two reigning models of ethics have been utilitarianism, and a version of something that comes from Kant, and that is that moral values are completely autonomous. And let me give, maybe I could give a couple quick examples of both those views. I mean, the utilitarian is going to want to claim that the reason I do something is to maximize utility.
Greatest good, greatest number.
Right.
That sort of stuff.
That seems to cause some problems for morality, because you can think of it counterexamples where
there's going to be that one exception.
Yeah, I mean, something like a very common example is, well, what if I see Hitler drowning? Well, it looks as if I may have a moral duty to save Hitler, but in terms of the overall, you know, utility to mankind, that seems to be a horrible choice. So there we seem to have a conflict between morality and utility. On the other hand, if you try to defend morality just on its intrinsically, there seem to be cases where choosing the moral action is going to have horrendous consequences, overall consequences. So I think where Greek ethics is interesting is that it doesn't try to draw that dichotomy. It tries to find a way that both morality and overall utility
have a kind
of coherent whole, and that we can talk about these things as kind of commensurate values.
Well, this word normative that you use brings us back, you know, as Phil was saying, to the interplay of ethics and science. Why is it that later in philosophical history, in the history of philosophy, why is it that later philosophers needed science to defend ethics? I mean, it simply because it had become the reigning sort of social institution, it was the pervasive form of authority for us in Western thinking?
Well, I think originally it's not not its institutional form which makes it so compelling. I think philosophers began looking at problems of ethical justification. And they soon saw that if you wanted to justify an ethical argument, you needed to begin appealing to things outside of ethics. I mean, take something like, I mean, this isn't necessarily an ancient example, but take something like abortion. Well, if I begin worrying about what a fetus is, I mean, I'm not only going to be checking my kinds of ethical intuitions about what a fetus is, but I may want, I'll have to rely on views about what personal identity is.
Yeah, personhood.
Personhood, what constitutes a person. That becomes a kind of metaphysical issue. I also will have to worry about identity. I mean, what makes a property the same over time? And at the same time, I mean, what I think is especially interesting about Greek thought is that the argument doesn't only go one way. I mean, I think we have, I mean, because of the power of science as an institution, we tend to try to derive ethical claims from our scientific views, and that is, we can't solve some of these scientific problems without, I mean, guiding our solution to these scientific problems our background ethical beliefs. And for a long time, I think scientists thought that, say with a problem like abortion, that we could solve these things independently, that our background ethical beliefs weren't somehow controlling our solutions.
How about Jennifer Whiting?
And that's what I'm suggesting now, that there's a trend against some philosophers now are suggesting that the notion of a person is an ethical notion, not a metaphysical one. Or as John Rawls at Harvard has suggested, a political notion, not a metaphysical one.
I see.
And the danger there is that
we're moving down the ladder of abstraction, aren't we? We're moving more toward the social and the concrete and the human rather than from the, and away from the metaphysical, as you say.
Right. But the danger there is that if we start saying that the notion of a person is not something which is fixed independently of our beliefs about what we are or of our society's attitudes towards personhood and what persons are, if we start saying that what it is to be a person is partly a function of how we conceive of persons, or partly a function of the the conception of persons in some sort of political institution, then we once again face this problem of relativism. Well, if different institutions conceive of persons in different ways, yeah. different societies have different conceptions of persons, or even within a society, if there are these alternative conceptions, if we can't fall back on some sort of metaphysical or scientific foundation to tell us, to correct our beliefs or our attitudes, then we once again face the problem of relativism. So I think it's interesting. We've got this problem of relativism, and we have people, especially like Aristotle, trying to answer that by appealing to metaphysical scientific views. And we have then skepticism about the metaphysical and scientific views, whether they can be established independently of our normative views. And then, once again, when we try to build in the normative components, we have the problem of relativism. I think in that sense, there's probably a sort of intuitive yeah. or implicit commitment to a virtue ethic.
In other words, Phil, it's just we're back to the Socratic dialogue. If not talking with other people, then talking with ourselves.
Right. I think that's true. And I think that as a kind of method for examining moral problems, mm-hmm. it's a very good one. I mean, it's tough to do. And one of the things that Socrates found is that if you do it a lot, you can get into trouble. You can make enemies. You can, you know, if you begin examining people out on the street who don't want to be examined, bad things yeah. can happen to you. But yeah. I think that
just a quick footnote here to our conversation. Why did the Athenians kill Socrates? Just be very brief about this for me.
Well, actually, that's recently been in a lot of magazines because I.F. Stone has recently written a book about that.
The old newspaper Muckery. Editor,
right? And I think his sort of central conclusion is that Socrates failed to do what I.F. Stone did, and that is to stand out against oppression.
You mean
a soapbox.
He accused him of not being the gadfly that we think of him
He was a gadfly in the sense that he went around to individuals and examined their beliefs, but uh-huh. he didn't go in for the grand political statement, and he didn't go in for, you know, writing newspaper articles against the regime. And I think that's why I.F. Stone thought that Socrates was condemned and maybe should have been condemned for kind of almost political apathy. But I think there's an interesting question there about who was really going about this in the right way. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think one of the things that Socrates thought was that if you really went around and talked to people, it had to be done on an individual basis, mm-hmm. that you could only change people's views if you submitted him to these tests.
We're back to the one true medium, radio. One voice speaking to one listener rather than television, one voice speaking to many.
Right. That you can't, he said, Plato says somewhere, you can't sort of just pour this into someone.
Right.
You have to sit down, carefully cross-examine them. They have to be a willing participant. They have to come forward with their own ideas and believe in them and be willing to have them tested. And usually that's not going to happen in a mass medium. And that's why I think he avoided that.
Philip Mitzis is a professor of classics at Cornell University. Jennifer Whiting teaches philosophy at the University of Pittsburgh. Philip Mitzis is at work on a forthcoming study entitled Science and Morality in Hellenistic Thought. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings on Science and Ethics continues. My guest now is the president of the University of Notre Dame, the Reverend Edward Malloy. Father Malloy recently visited North Carolina State University, where he delivered a talk entitled, When Science Makes It Possible, What Makes It Right? Here is the Reverend Edward Malloy.
Ethics, in my understanding of it, begins with values.
Uh-huh.
Values can only be held by people. Values are goals worth pursuing in human life. But most of us have a configuration of values which sometimes compete in our very existence.
Mm-hmm.
Survival, health, justice, for example, if we look at a particular kind of public policy issue, trying to decide which has priority in what particular kind of circumstance. If we have a model of human life where the individual is the predominant unit, mm-hmm. that's something different from if we look at the community, the group, the tribe, or if we're part of some movement of some kind. What we're trying to do, I think, with regard to ethics, is to help people in their own particular bailiwick, scientist, engineer, biotechnologist of some kind working for a private company or government regulator to recognize what's at stake and to find a language that can be persuasive in the public forum.
Uh-huh.
I think we've learned a lot, particularly in this country, with regard to process developing ways of allowing individuals from different backgrounds to contribute to public policy decisions. In one sense, much of that is made by either government agents or foundation heads or federal agency heads. But I think the formulation of guidelines, we find, for example, that there have been a number of presidential commissions mm-hmm. which have brought together people from different backgrounds, and as a result of their deliberations, they've come forward with very clear background historical information, indications of problems, and some workable guidelines that people of goodwill can agree about.
Mm-hmm. Father Beloy, you're replicating the democratic process. That's what I hear you saying. You are sort of imitating the American political system, getting everybody into the act and letting them help to make the decisions. But don't we have a problem in the sense that when we talk about the intersection of science and the citizenry and people who make public policy decisions, don't you have a necessary gap there in the sense that citizens are not scientists. They really don't know all of this high-tech stuff. They haven't been to school. They're not professionals. They may have moral persuasions. They may have positions from which they speak, but that doesn't necessarily make it right. I mean, we can't turn this thing into a democratic process, can we?
I have found in my own experience serving on institutional review boards in hospitals, being on panels with experts from medicine and law and mm-hmm. government, in scientific research.
Now, there's that wonderful word, the expert.
That's right. Everybody has their own jargon. Yeah. They have their own perspective. But I have found that educated people of goodwill who are striving to find effective mechanisms of social amelioration
uh-huh.
can come together and can arrive at consensus about the vast majority of issues that we face. To obscure the question by saying, as we often do, they know more about it than I do,
uh-huh.
is not been borne out in fact. I do not have to be an accomplished biologist or physicist to be able to understand the central questions at stake in funding awards with regard to that kind of research or national priorities or whatever it might be.
Uh-huh.
If the money comes from all of us together, then all of us together need to find tools that mm-hmm. will allow our contribution to count. And claims of expertise are not sufficient.
Father Malloy, let's put on the table a terrifying and an ominous issue, AIDS. As the United States, it's a worldwide problem, but as the American people face this difficulty, how do we figure out the proper mix of the voices of the policymakers, the voices of the scientists, the medical people, the people who speak from moral positions, as we attempt a solution toward figuring out, how to deal with this problem? What is the priority of issues there that you as an ethicist see when you look at the problem of AIDS?
My first instinct is to study from history what kind of analogical situations we can find. For example, the one that comes to mind readily with regard to AIDS is leprosy. There is also a resemblance to the question of venereal disease, because you find what in effect in the eyes of medical practitioners is a medical problem, like the plague was in the Middle Ages, can be redescribed as a punishment from God,
uh-huh.
as a matter of lifestyle choice, as a matter of education, of prophylactic methods,
yeah.
or whatever might be the case.
Uh-huh.
I think we need, in the initial public conversation, to bring as many points of view, historical, contemporary, social scientific, moral, ethical, religious, as we can, and see if we can formulate some kind of standard or approach to the question, which will allow us then to make progress with regard to funding questions, educational questions.
What do you say to people who claim that AIDS is, in fact, the judgment of God Almighty, that it is a moral plague, that it is not, to say simply, I don't mean to dismiss it, but that it is simply a biological or a medical problem? How do you respond to that?
Any human phenomenon is not simply a biological or medical issue. It's just one dimension, one kind of approach to it.
Mm-hmm.
It involves human choice. It involves the situation of children who are born with AIDS because of something their parents did. It surely, in the worldwide scheme, involves hetero and homosexual possibilities as well as drug use. It involves hemophiliacs and others who depend on blood donation. So we're seeing a very complex reality that is sometimes, in what I take to be misguided religious interpretation, mm-hmm. seen as a choice between good and evil, that one is simply being held accountable by God directly. My view of God does not incorporate that kind of immediacy of response, and I think that's just an inappropriate way of approaching it.
Father Molloy, what might be some of the other major public policy, scientific, health issues that you as a bioethicist look at and say, this is what people need to know about? We've discussed AIDS very briefly. What other kinds of issues represent this intersection of science and ethics for you?
I think we're finding that there has been a fairly good review and formulation of an approach in the area of human application, the use of humans, for example, in research. What's happening now is the extension across the species interrelationship, so that what's going on in animal and plant agriculture, the kind of research that's taking place there, the patenting of life forms, mm-hmm. the kind of ecological balance that people are striving to maintain, claims about the rights of animals and plants and inanimate objects. That's a kind of language that is not inherently appealing to everybody in the population. They can understand, if it's going to affect human beings, why we need to worry about it. What do I care about cows or pigs, or whether frost-resistant strawberries can be engaged in research projects?
Yeah.
I think what we're finding is an extension of public debate and concern that goes beyond simply human application.
What do you say to people whose ethics dictate the banning of animal experimentation altogether?
I think the soundest thing we can say is that we have subjected that to review, mm-hmm. to public conversation. There has been no mandate from the federal government or the state government restricting our use of animals, just regulating that we do it properly, that we think there is a good rationale presently for the use of animals in research, and we will continue that with as much control as is proper.
Mm-hmm. Father Molloy, what's the role of the Catholic Church as we look at issues of medicine, health, and science? Is the Church a leader? Is it a follower? What is its role in the formulation of policy?
Well, I could answer that in a number of ways. First of all, historically, particularly in the Western world, the two communities that cared about the so-called subdiscipline of medical ethics were Roman Catholics and Orthodox Jews. Generally, in the Protestant community and in the philosophical community, there were other kinds of issues that had more attention paid to them. When the American community, in responding to certain kinds of abuses, started getting interested in the question of medical ethics, and we had such rapid technological breakthroughs, all of a sudden people began to appeal to Pope Pius XII or Rabbi such and such, because that was the literature that existed.
Uh-huh.
Since that time, in the last 25 years, I think we've made rapid advances, and I think that the quality of conversation and the number of participants is better than it was before. In the Catholic Church that I come out of, we have a range of perspectives on some of the more controversial issues. And so one of the things built into it is the nature of the church and how teaching takes place within it. I think as the Catholic population in this country has become more educated and more sophisticated in their work life, we have had to provide a much better preparation and be much more persuasive. We, that is, members of the church community who try to represent it, in the way that we deal with some of these issues. I think the conversation is much improved, mm-hmm. and I think Catholics in our society are better prepared to exercise leadership roles with regard to these matters.
Father Molloy, let's conclude our conversation. Let me challenge you a little bit. What's your biggest challenge? What's the toughest nut that you have to crack? Something that's just inherent in university administration, or a problem that you face particularly at the University of Notre Dame?
I think the biggest challenge I have, and it really builds on the vision of my predecessor, Father Hesper, is to maintain, in a full sense of the term, the what some people take to be an oxymoron, Catholic University.
Well, you could say the same thing about Brigham Young or Southern Methodist,
right.
Any of these schools.
We would like, and I think we have done a decent job and want to continue to build on that, to be fully Catholic, not only in terms of the courses people take, but the kind of orientation they pick up, the value-oriented discussion that goes on, as well as a university in the full American sense of the term, a place where academic freedom is respected, where the tenure system has prevailed, and to keep the different groups who make up our university community convinced that our distinctiveness is our greatest strength.
But now, wait a minute. Isn't the Catholic Church known for not necessarily being the world's biggest fan of plurality and diversity of opinion?
Notre Dame is owned in trust by a lay board of control. And we receive $0 from the Catholic Church. We are loyal, respectful, institutional representatives at Notre Dame. We serve the church in a variety of ways. The best service that we can provide the church around the world, not just in this country, is to be a full Catholic university, to be a place where the church can do its thinking. That's the kind of goal and mission that I think is appropriate and one that I enjoy immensely.
The Reverend Edward Malloy is the president of the University of Notre Dame. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings on Science and Ethics is available on cassette. Send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Ask for program number 414. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, a discussion about college sports and academics. My guests will be Scott Sugar, a freelance journalist, and Woody Durham of the Tar Heel Sports Network. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. The first week in September, in 490 BC, marked the defeat of the Persians by the Athenians in the Battle of Marathon. In 1783, the signing of the Treaty of Paris, ending the American Revolutionary War. And in 1803, the birth of Prudence Crandall, the American schoolteacher who advocated the education of young black women. The first week in September also marks the anniversary of the declaration of World War II in 1939, of the first observation of Labor Day in 1882, and of the death of Mao Zedong, the Chinese communist leader, in 1976. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Partial support for Soundings comes from The Leader, News of the Research Triangle. Major funding for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Science and Ethics, Ancient to Modern, next on Soundings. How do Greek philosophers such as Socrates provide models for the study of ethics? How has the philosophy of ethics evolved into the modern world? Listen for Philip Mitsis of Cornell University, Jennifer Whiting of the University of Pittsburgh, and the Reverend Edward Malloy, President of the University of Notre Dame. Science and Ethics, Ancient to Modern, this week on Soundings.